We good to go?
Yeah.
Good morning. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy, Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 30th. We have one bill on the agenda today. This is House File 4118, Representative Miller. And welcome to the committee, Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, before you get started, I've been working on a potential new member here to get her to show up and engage in this, and I just wanted to, although I don't think she's officially been added to our committee, I would like to welcome Representative Kunesh Podine.
It happens all the time.
It's always nice when a guy in your own party mispronounces your name, right? So I feel a little bit better when I do it from the presiding chair. So, well,
thanks.
Well,
Fred,
do you want to introduce yourself to the committee, or just? I think we serve with you, so we know. But.
Sure. I'm Representative Mary Kunesh Podine. I represent Senate District 41B, which is Columbia Heights and Hilltop, the southern half of New Brighton and St. Anthony Village. And I was asked if I'd be interested in sitting in for Paul Thiessen's seat for the rest of the session, and I'm always up for learning something new, so I'd be happy to join you for a bit.
Great, fantastic. Well, if you enjoy learning, this is a great committee to be on. So,
except for jobs and housing.
Oh, geez. Let's here we go. Starting. Isn't it a little early for that, Tim?
You set the time.
So, Representative Miller, welcome to the committee. Please begin with your presentation, and I'm going to have you manage the time of your testifiers. And what we'll do is we'll try to get through public testimony, and then we'll have members' comments, member follow-up questions afterwards.
Perfect.
Obviously, there is a floor session, and people are going to want to prepare for it. So, as always, brevity. Get the information out. You got plenty of time, but brevity is important. So, Representative Miller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Garofino. And I just wanted to balance it out there, Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I really do want to thank you for coming this morning. I know it's 8 o'clock on a Monday morning at the end of session, and you didn't necessarily have to be here. Your tardiness would not have been strongly noted. So I really do appreciate your willingness to come in here and listen. I want to thank you for your flexibility in being here, and I also ask Mr. Chair, I did tell Mr. Seidel, I asked for a little bit more flexibility. In putting this together, we have before you what was referred to your committee 4118, and the language that I intended to lay over that in the DE was, I couldn't find the DE for this life of me, but it's basically House File 4114, and then it has an amendment that lays over that to address some of the OAH concerns that we'll get into later. But basically, members of the committee, for the sake of understanding this informational meeting, just refer to House File 4114 that I gave you in that green sleeve, and then there's the DE1, which changes a lot of the language in the OAH. And I will tell you, I also gave you a copy of the House research summary that Ms. Scholin did, which is fantastic, which really helps you understand that part of the bill. So, I'm cut through half my notes already, Mr. Chair, so this is going to be quick. Mr. Chair and members, the reason for this bill is to address problems created when this legislature passed and the governor signed into law legislation which allowed Xcel Energy to end its requirement to purchase power from Benson Power 11 years earlier than what was originally in statute. Also signed into law last year was legislation which used RFA dollars to account for the loss to the city of Benson. And, Mr. Chair, your committee moved that through, and I thank you very much for that as well. However, the original plans, although this was not set in stone, there was an assumption of probably about a 2 to 3 year period before the plant would be closed, which would have given enough time for vendors and customers of the byproduct to address their own challenges arising from this decision. That timeline has been greatly accelerated, and with the plant in position to close at any time now. This has left these companies with the stranded assets and sudden losses of income, which are going to be great. Myself and Representative Baker tried unsuccessfully to extend the timeline, and without that, we were forced with no other option than to provide compensatory relief through this bill. The basics of the bill are simple. We look to provide $40 million from the RFA, $20 million over two years, $20 million each year for 2 years, for a total of $40 million, to be placed in a separate account and to have the Office of Administrative Hearings determine who receives that compensation. Now, that's the basic tenets of this. The details get a little more complex, particularly when it comes to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So I work closely with stakeholders, with some members, with research, and with OAH to come up with language that we believe it's very tricky, members, to make this equitable, fair, and straightforward in this. And so after working with all that, and again, Ms. Stolen did a fantastic job, and I really want to thank her for that. That's the DE amendment that you have when we get into that, and that's the bill summary that will explain all that. As you said, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is bring testifiers forward to tell their story. After that time, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions to the tenets of this bill, or if there's, I assume that any testifier would be more than happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Yep.
So if you want to go ahead and...
Let's go with testifiers first. And I do believe you have, I think it's a complete list, but of course there may be one or two after that.
We will, if we have time, we'll invite it for public testimony as well.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. The first name I have on the list is Scott Dane, Executive Director of the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers of Minnesota. And then Steve Skellerud, I have you on deck. You're here, Steve?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Dane. I'm the executive director, as you mentioned, of the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers of Minnesota. Our trade association represents over 200 companies in Minnesota, and all the Benson suppliers are members of the ACLT as well. I just want to kind of give you a quick overview of the industry here. The timber industry in Minnesota represents 40,000 jobs and billions of dollars of economic impact. However, it's threatened. In the last 10 years, Minnesota's lost half of its forest products industry. In fact, last Friday, a company named Buildrite up in International Falls announced the closure of that facility and the loss of 44 more jobs. That's another market for forest products and timber products. And then late last year, as you know, Blandin announced a shutdown of one of its two remaining lines, laying off another 150 people in the timber industry. The reason I mention this is to kind of give you an overview of the threats to the industry. Now the biomass markets are closing with the XL legislation, and due to Blandin's announcement that they were going to be shutting down one of their lines, Rapids Energy, that burns biomass in Grand Rapids, is also converting early this summer to natural gas, and that's another market for biomass that's going to be lost in the state of Minnesota. So the timber industry is under threat, which will not only impact jobs and the economy, but it will negatively impact the sustainable forest management and health of Minnesota's forests. I see that the DNR is in the audience today. The DNR, the U.S. Forest Service, and St. Louis County, the largest county in Minnesota, have all registered concerns in writing to the public utility about the impact to forest management that the loss of these markets will have. Obviously, it's inevitable at this point that we're going to lose these markets. But the important thing to think about here is that we need to take action to help preserve the infrastructure. There may be in the future, who knows, new industries that may come into Minnesota that could represent the biomass sector, nothing that we're aware of right now. But if we lose the infrastructure and it collapses, it doesn't matter what the future efforts are to bring in new biomass industries into Minnesota. The infrastructure will be gone. As an example, I was in Colorado a few years ago. If you've ever been out to Colorado recently, half their forests are brown trees on the side of the forest. It's all lodgepole pine beetle killed. They looked around in Colorado and said, we need to have the loggers clean this fire hazard up. It's a real mess. And they said, where do our loggers go? And they said, oh, yeah, we ran them off 20 years ago. They're gone. They called Minnesota loggers to come down there, and we visited with them about possibly moving down there in the summertime and helping them clean that up. So my point is that it's important that we preserve this infrastructure, and this legislation is necessary because it will enable companies to avoid bankruptcy and survive. The last thing the legislature needs to be responsible for is contributing to the loss of jobs and forest management in Minnesota. This legislation will help preserve the jobs for these jobs and the forest management in Minnesota and keep our forests healthy. So that's kind of an overview. I just want to kind of put this into context of why it's important that we assist these people.
Thank you for your testimony. And will you be available for additional questions once we get through all the testimony?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I said Steve Scalarud and then Randy Tiersteg. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Good morning. My name is Steve Scalarud, and I'm the owner of Hall's Brothers Trucking out of St. Joseph, Minnesota. We employ about 50 people. About 55% of our revenue is generated by hauling turkey litter to Benson Power. That amounts to about 25 to 30 end dump loads per day. It is extremely specialized equipment. It's not just a truck and a trailer. It's designed to haul litter. Most things that are hauled in end dumps are very heavy, very dense, granite, gravel. We need huge trucks to get up to weight. Because of this, the equipment is not easily repurposed. I have a 30% higher cost per ton hauling anything other than litter. So my ability to repurpose this equipment is not good. What we're asking for is money to be able to buy different equipment and repurpose and save companies. My company is but one example of companies who have committed to this business and are in serious financial trouble without some help. I bought the company 2 years ago with a 14-year time horizon based on the legislation. Last spring it was repealed, so I will now have the last 2 years and nothing going forward with which to repay $8 million in debt. In trucking, backhauls are critical to sustainable margins. So if you're running empty to or from a paying haul, that's a direct cost that comes away. So when you take away a revenue source that represents 55% of total, you can't even break even based on your current customer base. And it takes time to replace something that represents 55% of your business. The continued operation of the plant for 3 to 5 years, frankly, would be my preference. It doesn't seem like that's in the cards. I think what you'll hear from the rest of the folks here and myself today is, we don't want to come down here and ask for help. We just want a way to run our business. And, frankly, my ability to provide 50 jobs is difficult even with this compensation, but I can save a lot of them. Without it, I don't think I can save any because I think it's a bankruptcy situation. The compensation would allow many of us to pay down debt to a level where we can survive, repurpose, regroup, and try to run a company forward. The abruptness of the closing of the plant is, frankly, most of the problem. If this had a 5-year wind down, I think most of us could do it without help. But that part of the conversation seems to have ended. And I guess the other thing that I think is frustrating myself and many others is that with Xcel's ratepayers saving somewhere around $700 million, we seem to be pole vaulting over $40 million to keep 10 or 15 businesses alive, the businesses that frankly supported the very industry. So as I look at it, the legislature created an industry with legislation that was put together in 1994. Benson started to run in 07. It ran for 10 or 11 years, and which is about halfway through what we business owners felt was going to happen. And when you make business decisions and investments worth millions and millions of dollars based on that kind of time horizon, it's very difficult to function when it gets cut in half. someone in the Senate asked me, well, what were you going to do in 2028 when this eventually came to an end? And my answer was, in 2024, I quit buying equipment, not 2028. I bought 2 years ago, I bought $8 million worth of equipment. Last year, prior to the announcement and the legislature taking action, repealing the biomass mandate, I bought another $1.5 million worth of equipment, assuming that we were going to continue to run this. So I'm trying to dimensionalize for you why this compensation is so important. And I appreciate your time today, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. And, sir, will you be available for questions later on today as well? Thank you very much. Randy Trustig. And then Jody Walsh, are you here? You're on deck, Jody. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Good morning. Randy Trustig. I'm speaking today on behalf of two companies in which I play a leading role. I'm the president and CEO for North American Fertilizer, a company which handles the ash material, which is created from the burning of biomass at the Benson power facility. The ash produced from the burning of turkey litter provides ingredients, which is valuable as fertilizer. I also represent Beaver Creek Transport, a company that provides transportation services hauling turkey litter and other biomass to the plant to supply its needs. These are two companies that have been built around serving the power plant. We have a great deal at stake, having invested approximately $15 million of equipment which cannot easily be converted to other purposes. Both of these companies had agreements with the companies spanning an entire 22-year commitment that was left in the biomass mandate. And we feel that that commitment was not only made by our contracting companies, but as well by the state of Minnesota's mandate. We're so closely integrated with the power plant that our permanent equipment is installed within the power plant. They cannot operate without us. We cannot operate without them. We have no other options. The day the plant closes, we are financially ruined. North American Fertilizer generates in excess of $5 million of gross revenue each year under the agreement. With 11 years remaining on the agreement, we'll lose approximately $60 million in revenue. North American Fertilizer's largest stakeholders are the Bird Island Soil Service Cooperative, which is a cooperative made up of 240 farmers in western Minnesota. Many of whom would have liked to attend today. However, with the late spring as the first day, many of them were hoping to actually get in the field. So Bird Island Soil Service purchases the fertilizer from North American Fertilizer and in turn retails that to its members, increasing revenue to the farmer owners of the cooperative. The farmers and other owners and investors in North American stand to lose profits they would realize under the agreement. In addition, the owners face significant stranded capital. There are no other businesses to utilize or businesses we can acquire to utilize ash handling fertilizer manufacturing equipment that was specifically designed for just this process. Beaver Creek Transport also has contractual relationships with Benson Power and North American Fertilizer. They deliver poultry litter to the facility and manage the wood yard to ensure that fuel is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, to ensure the facility never runs out of biomass, and it never has. Beaver Creek's relationships with the facilities have generated in excess of $4.5 million of gross revenue per year. With 11 years left on agreements, they will stand to lose approximately $50 million in gross revenue. Since the legislator approved the closing of the plant last year, I have worked and traveled endlessly to find a replacement business for these two companies. Beaver Creek Transport has already invested upwards of $1 million on research and equipment in hopes of starting a new venture. However, without receiving the funds that we would have received operating these two companies, we will not be able to rebuild. The time will not allow. It's a significant impact to western Minnesota. The success these two companies achieved did not come easily. For the past 12 years, I have put almost all my resources and time into managing these two companies. North American Fertilizer was the first of its kind in the United States. I had to personally guarantee all of the loans for these two companies. I had to make sure our fertilizer facility was operational at the same time as the power plant, because they could not start without us. I felt proud in the fact we were providing good jobs, returns for our investors, and producing a fantastic renewable fertilizer product. of all the risks we took, from financial to product acceptance, never did I imagine that the state of Minnesota would be the one that would put us out of business. Our livelihood, my family's livelihood, the investment of 240-plus farmers, all of our employees that were counting on me. I was shocked the day I heard about the potential legislation to close the plant, which, by the way, I first became aware of when I read it in the newspaper. As I stand back and look at what has been approved over the last year, I see the average ratepayer will save a few dollars on their electric bill. I see Xcel Energy is making a great return on money they are investing to buy out power plants. I see the city of Benson will receive $20 million, more than they invested, more than they would have received in property taxes. I see the state of Minnesota can change rules with little regard to what can happen to companies such as mine. And I see my companies and the companies of my peers, the people who have worked the hardest, risked the most, are being absolutely financially ruined. I don't feel it's right. Legislators have asked me, why do you feel the state should offer support? And they have said to me, you're a businessman, those are the risks that you take. My response is, absolutely business owners take risks. If this business loss was due to my inability to perform as promised, I would be embarrassed and certainly not here asking for help today. If the biomass mandate had expired its full term, I would not be here today. I would not expect any money from anyone. However, that is not the case. This mandate was an insurance policy that provided a safety net for these investments, so much so that the 22-year mandate was the only way we were able to borrow money to build these businesses. Financial institutions used the mandate as financial security for our loans. I understand a bill is being offered that will offer relief to businesses such as ours, which I greatly appreciate. However, as Mr. Miller mentioned, the $40 million, I feel isn't even close to the amount that's going to allow a lot of these companies to survive. Remember, just the two businesses I mentioned have invested upwards of $15 million and will lose over $100 million in gross revenue over the remaining 11 years. So I thank you for inviting me to tell my story today, and we'll certainly answer any questions anyone may have.
Thank you. So you'll be available for questions later?
Yes, thank you.
Maybe just one quick question. I've been curious. When we had the turkey flu epidemic, back in, Dave, what year was that?
15.
In 2015. How did you handle supplying the plant at that time? Because in my recollection, maybe Representative Baker, you can lie, my recollection is that it was kind of basically herds were just wiped out. So where did you get supply for turkey litter then?
That would have just been subsidized. The shortage of turkey litter would have been subsidized with wood shavings, just full wood products at that time, and very little poultry litter. There were still small amounts of poultry litter coming in, but it was subsidized by wood for that time period.
So just primarily used wood. And how did that address the fertilizer side of things when that was happening?
That rendered our fertilizer very, very tremendously. The value was very little during that, I'm going to suggest, maybe a six-month period.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, and again, thank you, Randy, for coming down this morning. And I may ask Steve to come back later as well, but one of the things I wanted to make sure gets covered today is how your contracts and cancellation process was handled. Maybe up to where you heard about this closing pending, what has been sort of the trend in the past of if you've had to renew any contracts between the beginning and sort of what has sort of taken place in the history. And as others come forward too, I want to know what they have informed you or communicated to our vendors about their sort of either changes in any cancellation clauses or whatever. I'd like to hear your bit on that if I could, please.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'll back up maybe even a little earlier, and the case of North American Fertilizer, there were contract stipulations that were not being met on the side of the power plant. So through negotiating terms, approximately 10 days before this announcement was made public, they renegotiated terms that fixed a lot of previous issues. again, approximately 10 days before we read about this in the newspaper. Obviously, there were negotiations being taken place. So for them to come renegotiate and a big push for us to finally sign, I should have been smarter to say, why have we been doing this for such a time period? Our contracts with North American Fertilizer were 22.5-year contracts. There were, as long as the plant ran, we were there for 22.5 years. So the fix there was a fix to fix something that they were in non-compliance with. So that was obviously unethical, I think, would be an understatement. Beaver Creek Transport as well, shortly, days before this announcement came into paper, contracts were negotiated. So,
and when the plant went through bankruptcy, the power plant went through bankruptcy, I forget when the years were. Can you kind of walk us through that time frame and kind of the events of the power plant itself when it was going through bankruptcy, how it was addressed then?
Sure. Well, to my knowledge, I don't believe it ever technically filed bankruptcy. It was given back, you know, to continue operations. So as far as operational standpoints, we saw no difference in operation as far as the fertilizer plant or the trucking company. The plant, you know, continued to run. And a lot of our original value to the contracts, you know, we hire, before we invest this amount of money, we hire professional auditors and people that look at these contracts and say, what could happen? What are the risks associated with this? So as we evaluated that, you look at the numbers, and once a facility is built, that capital cost is really spent. It's done. So when we evaluate that, we look at it and say, okay, forget the capital repayments, but does the plant cash flow at least more than its operational costs are? And the plant did cash flow above those operational costs. So even though the plant was taken back, there is still a confidence level that it would continue to run because the plant is more valuable running than sitting there empty. So the only way for them not to run was this legislation to change. So, you know, we had significantly amount of time and people much smarter than myself that researched that and do those studies before we would spend that amount of time. So that is where our financial institutions came back and really felt that with the state mandate in place, it was a safe investment. As long as I did what I promised to do, it was a safe investment.
Thank you, Chair. Oh, Representative Baker.
Thank you.
And then if Ms. Walsh wants to come down, sorry, you're ready to go.
Just to make sure I get it clear here, Randy, so you had an agreement initially that was about a 20-year window. When I say cancellation clause, I'm not sure if that's what it was. If they basically said, unless you mess up, you will have this business, you know, for 20 years. So when you renegotiated, apparently 10 days before the announcement, was that cancellation clause changed, or was that part of the negotiations, or is that still part of your safety net now, or did they mess with that part of that agreement?
That was like a last-minute deal. A cancellation clause was entered, and unfortunately, you know, we felt confident. We were continually told about the long-term plan and the long-term fixes, and the new ownership committed to finishing the remainder of the 11-year contracts. It was disheartening, to say the least. Yes. Okay. There was no termination in my agreement till that couple days before the paper announcement.
Who were the new owners? Was it John Hancock?
Well, the new owners were actually Benson Power, which is insurance companies. So they always were the owners. It was just on a lease. So as that lease, that was kind of what people considered bankruptcy. The company that was leasing it basically gave it back to the new owners and said, we're going to discontinue this lease. So the owners at that time, who were the original investors, hired a company to come in and run and manage the power plant. So it was really being run for, don't quote me, but John Hancock, Prudential, those gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Walsh, and then Sean Fletcher.
Good
after that will be Craig. And, Craig, I'm not going to try to butcher your name. You're from Red Willow Management, LLC. Are you here, Craig? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jody Walsh, and I am married to a third-generation logger. And together with family, we operate our logging business, which is Dick Walsh Forest Products, and we are located just north of Park Rapids, Minnesota. Dick Walsh Forest Products has been in business for over 60 years, along with operating several logging crews and 9 semi-tractors and trailers, which haul our product. We also contract with 3 independent trucking agencies. Those agencies have anywhere from 1 to 12 trucks of their own that they operate. All of this is needed to keep our product moving to Benson. Our work mainly consists of producing biomass for the Benson plant. So the impact of the closure will close our doors as well as many other doors that are business related to ours. Our business was not always dependent on biomass production. But since signing contracts 10 years ago, we changed our business plan to meet the needs of the Benson plant. We have been supplying the plant for 10 years, and that work currently represents 90% of our business. When the closure happens, we will have to lay off all of our employees. Losing this contract would destroy 60 years of work, and there is no recovery. The families devastated by the loss of their jobs would be insufferable. These families and our communities rely on these jobs and this industry. A majority of our employees have been with us for 10, 15, and we have several that have also worked with us for 25 years. This is a family business. We support many people in our area. We have the loans that would be defaulted on would add up to millions, and the repercussions on our rural banks, financial institutions, and vendors would be devastating. The domino effect from the closure of this plant would put the rural communities in Minnesota in total upheaval. We have ourselves over $5 million invested in equipment alone. With the Benson contract, we would end up in default with no recovery. Like I stated, our business plan is dependent on this plant to continue to operate. Please understand that the veins of this contract run farther than we can all imagine. The ripple effect is incredible. The closure of the Benson plant will kill many small businesses like ours all over greater Minnesota. So I am humbly asking the committee today to please support us so we can redirect our businesses and continue to keep our employees and our families and our communities productive throughout greater Minnesota. I greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Sean Fletcher. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sean Fletcher with Fletcher Trucking. And I'm not just a trucker. I'm a very big logger. We don't have it on our name, but we're a large logger. We supply fuel to Benson Power and to Laurentian Energy, both. I've invested over $12.5 million since 2014 to meet the biomass supply needs of Benson Power. I have loans from 5 to 15 years on my biomass equipment and buildings to maintain the equipment. I relied on this biomass mandate just like everyone else did. I expect it to run through 2028, and that was definitely our business plan. Back in 2016, I met with the owner of Benson Power, or the manager, Don Atwood, and we agreed to a price negotiation. And at that point, he said we got to get the prices in line to make it right for Excel, so this place will run until 2028. And we agreed to take a price cut, and he assured us that it would run until 2028. After that, I bought a bunch more equipment to try to make my operation more efficient yet, newer, lighter, whatever I could do. So we have big plans for this to run until 2028. I'm not going to be able to just start hauling anywhere else. Like I said, we go to Hibbing also, so we don't even have that as a backup plan. In fact, Thursday they called me and said Friday is our last day. Friday was our last day of haul there, so it's already began. Dealers won't even take this equipment on trade. Everybody's like, well, we can just go do something else, take this equipment, do something else. This virtually taken, you know, Hibbing, Virginia, and Benson, not just Benson. For me, it's a lot more than that. I have numerous timber sales that I purchased in advance that we log and chip. And we'll chip all the low-grade species of the wood. And we have a lot invested in that also. It ain't just... we have a lot of money out for timber purchases that we can't utilize now. All of us will lose millions while Excel's ratepayers save pennies on their bill. I think we should all be made whole. Even this $40 million is only half of probably my debt on this deal, my share of it. I think Excel's ratepayers should pay for this. They're saving $700 to $800 million. This $40 million is nothing compared to that. I'd like to see the payment format simplified a little bit. Some maybe off the contract volumes and net profit per year using a basic accounting method, something a little bit more simple. My loan payments are my overhead is $100,000 a week, if that gives you a concept of how much money this is to me. The way it's set up, the payment schedule, it'd take 240 days even if it does go through. I mean, it sure be nice to get that down somehow sooner than that. 240 days is a long time to wait, even if you do get it through. And I really appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to me today. I thank Mr. Miller for putting this forward.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. And you'll be available for questions as well afterwards?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Craig Matinsky? Not even close, right?
I'll answer to just about that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
My name is Craig Matuszynski. That's the way my grandparents would say it anyways. And I am a representative. I represent some of the folks you've heard here, but about 70% of the fuel supply chain for the Benson Power Facility. Last year you were brought a package by Excel, and I do believe Excel were trying to do the right thing by their ratepayers by trying to lower the cost. It had become clear. I actually happened to work for Excel at the time that the original mandate was put in place. I was the director of corporate strategy for the company at that time, and I think it became clear over the years that two things happened. One was that biomass, which was originally expected to be expensive, continued to be expensive and got a little bit more expensive. More significantly, for the energy mix, wind, which was projected to be relatively expensive, became cheaper, about a third the cost of the original projections. And the combination of those two things really drove the biomass situation to where it became uneconomic and really unsustainable. And what Excel tried to do made some sense. Unfortunately, Excel's plan did not consider all of the factors, all of the consequences to the decision to try and undo the biomass piece of that mandate. And the story that you all got last year, I think, was probably incomplete. I think you were told that equipment could be easily redeployed. Not the case. The types of vans that are used for hauling biomass are large. They will not handle gravel and other construction materials easily. So there is investment there that cannot be recovered, cannot be redeployed. Chippers that are used to prepare the wood chip fuel cannot be redeployed to a market where there is no wood chip market, which is quickly, as we heard, becoming the situation in the state of Minnesota here and elsewhere around the country. I've heard stories where the Morbark chipper dealer in northern Minnesota would love to turn his franchise back because he can't sell any equipment. I mean, it's tough out there for these types of businesses. Since the time that Benson began operation in 2007, the group of companies that I've been working with has invested more than $120 million total in equipment. $50 million of this investment came after 2014, which was after roughly the bankruptcy of the original bankruptcy of the Benson facility. This investment was made in good faith. It was based on the understanding that the mandate would continue to exist, that the plant would run through the 2028 term. And as you heard, you know, the owner of the plant at the time that these contracts were renegotiated represented as much. So, in effect, this plant has ran half the life. It has, and there remains roughly half of the investment that is unrecovered. The total economic loss for the group of companies that I represent here is about $62 million. And that, of course, is not all of the economic loss. You heard from the fertilizer plant in Beaver Creek that there's an adder to that. And there are others out there that are not included here today and that will push that number. My estimation is that number is probably closer to $90 to $100 million of total economic loss by this group. The economic loss is going to be, you know, the actual losses will go beyond just the economic loss because, as you heard, we're talking about potential bankruptcy by some of these companies anyways. There's at least $50 million of debt outstanding and leases outstanding on with the companies that I represent on equipment. You can do, you know, quick math, $40 million, less than $50 million. It won't help them pay off all of their debts. You heard also about the time frame that is associated with getting the payments, and depending the House time frame, I think, is relatively quick compared to what's happening in the Senate, where it could drag out till the fall of 2019 before these payments are received. I will tell you, with having dealt with banks before, and you all have dealt with banks also, I'm sure, that banks can be kind of an unforgiving group at times. And, you know, three-quarters of a year to a year and a half to get payment or to forbear on payment absent a bankruptcy proceeding, you know, can be pretty substantial. So I guess what I'm arguing is that, or what I'm saying is that, you know, the time frame would, ideally, you heard, you know, we'd continue to operate for a few years, we'd wind this down, there would be an orderly shutdown of the facilities, and you know, it would lessen the burden on everybody to go that route. That is not apparently in the cards, and Excel would argue that they can't do that because the commission has already approved the more or less immediate shutdown of the facility once they get the proper all the proper pieces in place, and these plants will go away. So yes, we need some help on that schedule. Excel's ratepayers are going to benefit to the tune of $700 million. That is what is in Excel's filings that they made with the Public Utilities Commission. The owners of Benson actually will have received a 50% premium to their book value associated with the buyout of the facility from by Excel when that happens. The city of Benson, as you heard, will receive approximately two times the revenues that they would have received from the property tax payments had the plant continued to operate through to the 2028 time frame. So they would have received about $900,000 a year and in over an 11-year period. Instead, they're going to receive $20 million over a four-year period as it's set up now. The cities of Virginia and Hibbing said we like the double, we'll take more. They're actually in a better position than the city of Benson in the deal that they struck. We're requesting, and I think there's good reason for it, that the size of the compensation pool pot be increased. That $40 million will not be sufficient to even cover the debt of the people that are going to be affected here. And that's after you consider some mitigation. You'll salvage value for equipment, which can be very, very low. In the case of the fertilizer plants, you heard it's going to be, if it has to be removed, it'll be cents on the pound for the equipment, a lot of it. But similarly with some of the equipment on the logger side. We ask that the time frame to allow payments that take place be no longer than 90 days. And we think that we can get to the point of being able to get forbearance from the banks if they know the payments are coming, and they know the payments are coming in a relatively expedited time frame. The original 94 legislation that authorized the spent fuel at Prairie Island, you remember, there, if you recall, for those that were around, I don't know if any of you were, there was a requirement for closed-loop biomass. And specifically, that closed-loop requirement was in place because there was a recognition that rural Minnesota, by storing the casks next to the Prairie Island facility and ultimately the Monticello facility, as it turns out, were going to accrue the cost of keeping the Prairie Island plant open, while the benefit of keeping the plant open was going to accrue to the Xcel ratepayers, largely in the Twin Cities. And those benefits were substantial. Those benefits were basically, at the time, being able to avoid building a new coal plant somewhere on the east side of town to replace the power that would have been lost by Prairie Island had they not had the ability or kept the ability to offload the full reactor cores at the plant. What happened last year, if it isn't corrected, will effectively ensure that rural Minnesota, and unfortunately it is the companies represented here and other companies involved in the supply chain, end up subsidizing Xcel's ratepayers, and so that Xcel's ratepayers can get an additional $700 million in savings while these people, many of them, lose jobs, lose their businesses, and end up in a real world of hurts. So that's
what happens. Thank you for your testimony. And will you also be available for questions?
I will make myself available.
Thank you. Next on the list, from Jenny O'Turkey, is it Paul Bull?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Miller.
I don't have the list in front of me. Are we doing okay with numbers and time? Are we?
Yeah, I mean, I have two more testifiers after this, and I don't know if there's any other members of the public who wish to testify.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the time and appreciate the opportunity to test in front with this committee today. My name is Matt Shrupp. I'm with Genio Turkey Store. I am the Vice President of Live Production at Genio. And with me is also with me is Paul Boley, who's product manager for the area that we're discussing with the litter product. So closure of Benson Power certainly impacts Genio. We asked for support and consideration moving for reimbursement to suppliers of Benson Power. And I'll now turn it over to Paul for some comments.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
My name is Paul Boley, and I work at Genio. I manage, actually, the products we're talking about here. So, again, thank you for your time. I'll get a little closer to just a little history, and I think it's kind of important to know that from the beginning, Genio was, we were pulled into this agreement. We weren't an advocate or pushing for the biomass plant. There wasn't a big financial gain for us to be a biomass fuel supplier, largely because of legislation we're in the contract we're in today. We weren't really compensated very well for the litter throughout the years, and there were times that we could have made significant more revenue by land applying and selling the manure as a fertilizer. When Benson Power facility went into receivership, that was an opportunity that some folks took to get out of their contracts. And it was discussed, should we do the same and make more revenue? The management team at Genio emphasized the importance of honoring our commitment, and we could continue to supply the manure as a fuel and honor our contractual agreement with Benson Power. As it's been discussed, the purchase power agreement goes to 2028, and all of our strategic planning was based on that. That plant was going to run for another 10 years. Considering the sudden closure, the cost impact of Genio is significant. Close to 50% of our total volume now is going to have to get redirected into land application. Doubling that volume.
What percent was that?
Shy of 50% of our total volume. That type of influx of volume is going to surely dilute the marketplace and depress any kind of revenue that we're going to get currently and with the additional volume. We have been forced to hire an outside agronomy firm, consulting firm, to help us responsibly manage this additional volume. You just can't spread it wherever you want it. You have to be responsible to the nature. And so we're in contract negotiations with an agronomy firm right now. All the freight costs that were picked up on the litter being transported to the plant are now being picked up by Genio completely. And we simply have to move that litter even further to, again, responsibly spread it as a fertilizer product. In addition to that, we're exploring multiple storage facilities to handle all this volume. So with the diluted market, hiring consultants, freight, storage, the total annual impact over the remaining 10 years is somewhere around $20 million. Matt.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Just to reiterate, shareholders and stockholders and part of the 7,000 employees at Genio's Turkey Store are impacted by this cost. It's important to understand that there's people behind. It's not a big company. It's the people of Genio. It's the people, the stakeholders, the shareholders that are impacted by this result and this additional cost. It's been documented in statements that there's more than $700 million in savings, and we feel that the folks that have been suppliers to this should be fairly treated and compensated for their losses with the sudden change of the contract. And we recommend approval and consideration for compensating the suppliers associated with this. So thank you, and happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The last testifier I have is Pete Rothfork from the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pete Rothfork. I'm a second-generation independent turkey grower in Stearns County. Minnesota is the number one turkey producing state in the United States. Our economic impact is over $800 million. There are 450 turkey growers in the state of Minnesota. 225 are independent operators, such as myself. Minnesota is one of the last of three states that have independent turkey growers. I'm speaking on behalf of not only my operations, but of the many smaller independent operators whose responsibilities keep them from being here today. Along with my daughter, brother-in-law, and four nephews, we raise 1 million turkeys a year. We market 20,000 turkeys a week approximately. After each flock is gone, we clean out our barns completely. We produce about 18,000 ton of manure a year. 9,000 of that went to Benson Power. We've been with Benson Power since the beginning because it was a good source for us to take our manure in the winter and summer months. The farmers that we sell the other half of our manure to want the manure in the spring and the fall. In the summer, the crops are in the field. In the winter, the ground is frozen. So Benson was an ideal spot for us to take our litter to because it provided us a market for those months that we cannot sell it to the farmers. Our operation employs 34 full-time people in the feed mill and the farms. We also own part of a processing plant in Marshall, Minnesota, where we process our birds. Since the beginning, we have sold half our litter to Benson. The other half goes to farmers for fertilizer. We need to develop new fields and build storage facilities to hold the manure for the summer and especially the winter months. I need to find a home for 9,000 ton of manure. That's approximately 3,000 acres of land because you spread manure at approximately 3 ton per acre. Already the economic impact to us is that the price of manure has gone from over $20 a ton to $14 a ton right now, over a 25% drop. And that's just since word of the Benson plant closing. So what we need to do is develop storage facilities because my MPCA manure management plan states that the manure will not stay on my farms for more than 10 days. In some of my farms in Stearns County, it's 7 days that it has to be removed. The crop farmers can store the farm on their land, but I am not allowed to store it on my turkey farms. So I'll have to buy a piece of land, build a storage facility, and then sell the manure to them in the spring and fall when they want it. A lot of the people that you've heard from today have already made their investment in the equipment that was necessary to haul their product to Benson. My investment is still to come because with Benson going away, I need to store the manure on my facilities. I'd like to thank you for your time. I appreciate you listening to my comments, and I will be available for questions.
Thank you for your testimony. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments.
Mr. Chair, if I could, before we roll into the questions, thank you. I just want to punctuate that last point. One of the things, again, what I said earlier in the beginning of my testimony is we were dealing with a very truncated timeline, and some of the testifiers have mentioned that this has exacerbated the problem. When it comes to the turkey litter, this is a very complex thing because this also brings in the MPCA, as the last testifier had mentioned, that it's not so easy just to deal with these large, large quantities of manure. And that's why Jenny O said they're into bill storage. That's why all these people that have this turkey manure, they could have accommodated this if there was more time, but there's just not the time.
And does anyone, just for any of the testifiers, anyone can come forward to answer this question. I'm just curious why turkey litter has to be moved from the farm after 1 week, but if it's at another location, then it can sit there for a longer period of time. Do you know, Representative Miller, why?
Mr. Chair, if you can answer these questions about the MPCA, I would certainly love to hear this. But this is just
I kind of thought that's what the answer would be.
Yes, that's what the answer is.
Sorry I even asked. So if Mr. Dane, if you're still here. And then Mr. Turk said if you could come down as well. First of all, are there any other questions from members of the committee?
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker.
I guess I'm just kind of curious after Mr. Dane is done, and I have a few other questions, too, if I could have XL come down, too, for some questions.
Sure. So, Mr. Dane, the understanding that we were given is that the insurance companies, after I use the term bankruptcy, receivership, it wasn't a positive cash flow entity, went into receivership. Is that regardless of the action the legislature took last year, that eventually this plant, the time frame uncertain, was going to shut down because, candidly, the insurance companies didn't want to be in the biomass industry? What, in the event of that taking place, what would have been the response to the community? How would those suppliers have dealt with that?
And Mr. Chair, committee members, as others have testified, they wouldn't have been investing millions of dollars as they approached the determination of the agreement. At the same time, there are potentially new and evolving industries that may fill this spot. As an example, when the biomass mandate went through, that was exactly the same time when Ainsworth shut down three plants in Minnesota. So we had a big loss of market. And so when the biomass markets opened up, that provided another option for timber resources to go to. So to answer your question, these people would have planned accordingly, potentially had the time to shift into new industries, or new industries may have been developed as well to provide biomass or biofuel or bioenergy industries. But at this time today, those industries are not established yet.
Mr. Turk said there's a outbreak in Minnesota of emerald ash borer with there's going to be an incredible amount of trees, particularly in the metro area, that are going to need to be destroyed. We're going to have more wood chips we know what to do with when this thing goes full. Are there opportunities for your industry in that, or explain why or why not?
There's really not. The value in our fertilizer products came strictly from the manure. For the same reason, the farmers will use turkey manure as fertilizer. All of those nutrients are still in that fertilizer or that litter after they're burned, other than the nitrogen is lost during the heating process. But the phosphorus, potash, and all the micronutrients that are so beneficial were all still in that litter. And the advantage of, as some other people testified about, you know, what did they do with their litter in summer months or the winter months, the beauty of this whole project is it solved those problems, and it provided us with an ingredient that we were able to make a very uniform product that we specifically shipped. 80-some percent of our product was shipped in the month of October. So it was an extremely environmental-friendly situation, because it was applied right after harvest and immediately worked into the ground. So that is where the value came. So I will say I've looked significantly at, you know, district energy, other plants, and if they're strictly burning wood or products such as wood, the nutrient value is so minimal that majority of those companies actually landfill it.
Thank you both for your answering the questions. Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Terstig. You've developed a good business with North American Fertilizer. And a couple of questions. Was Bird Island the only retail place that you you distributed the fertilizer?
Mr. Turk?
Thank you for the question. Originally, we had about 7 dealers. And over the course of the years, our main supplier or our main customers were the Bird Island Soil Service, Beaver Creek Transport as well, retail to farmers, Cargill for many years, and Mosaic Company also sold probably the largest portion of our products to farmers through their retail locations in western Minnesota.
Mr. Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So being your business was so intertwined with the plant in Benson, what was your end game for when the plant was going to shut down in 11 years? How would you keep your business going, or could you, in the surety that the plant was going to shut down?
Mr. Tierstead.
Right. We struggled with that. Our whole plan was based on that 22-year project. We understood we needed to have our debt gone and profits assumed, hopefully, by the end of that 22 years. Again, As I said, I probably, since the announcement, I've probably worked harder than I ever have in my life looking for alternatives. We've talked to large fertilizer manufacturers, many groups, you know, startup companies, hemp, you know, is one of the things in Minnesota. I mean, we've looked at just all kinds of aspects, and I, you know, we really hope we'll fill that, but I don't think time's on our side today to be able to survive to get to that point.
At this point, Representative Baker, you request. Thank you for your testimony, both of you. Representative Baker, you requested some individuals from Excel come down.
Yeah, if I could have Mr. Evans come down. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record, and we'll go to Representative Baker for his question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy.
Representative Baker.
Thank you very much, and good morning, Mr. Evans. Morning. Nice to see you again. I know we were sitting here a year ago, a little more than a year ago, before Easter, and that's kind of when this kind of came out, at least to our attention. I think on my way home that day, I was still a little bit in shock because I wasn't sure what we just heard. He was on the phone all that weekend with Representative Miller, and then I called my friend Matt Schrupp from Jenny O, and I said, have you heard anything about this yet? And I think everybody's sort of like a little shocked by that. I think we're asking you a few questions after that, a few weeks after. I think it was getting towards the wind-down period of our session a year ago. I was asking a few questions about rates and how much are we actually able to see that reduction, because we were hearing numbers of $700 million, $800 million. It was a big number, and it got my attention, too. I did not want to see ratepayers pay more than they needed to. And at the time, Representative Miller and I, we were scrambling to try to help the one that really jumped forward, which was the city of Benson. And I also want to appreciate your help and work on that, too, Mr. Evans. Since that time, have you been able to kind of get a better handle on what kind of rate savings some of these average residential homes are seeing? I know when I asked the questions last year, you weren't quite there yet. We've had some more time. So just can you give us, the committee, some averages of what folks are really going to see with this kind of savings? Because with Excel being so big, it's a big number, but you guys have a lot of zeros behind everything you do. So I'm just kind of curious if you can help us with that.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, you know, I should be able to get that very quickly. I don't want to give you the wrong number off the top of my head. We've, in the proceedings before the Public Utilities Commission, which grew out of this legislation, we cited a lot of information about the cost impacts and what those cost impacts will be. And rather than try to remember what those were and get it wrong, I will share that with all the members of the committee before the morning is out, probably. I know I have that. I will point out that, you know, a lot of the rate pressure that we get is not from our residential customers, though they're concerned too, but our large industrial customers whose monthly bills are sometimes in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so these are important to them as well.
Representative Baker.
And Mr. Evans, I do know that, and I appreciate that. I think for this committee, We think of that on, I was thinking commercial, industrial, and residential. I'd like to know what those numbers are. I think it's good things to hear. Also, a year ago when we brought this to our attention, I had heard that your request of the legislation and the legislature to bring this forward last year was not necessarily the linchpin to maybe continue to move forward with your request to the PUC to shut down Benson. It was a component, though. Could you explain what that request was again and why we were needed and why that was brought to us versus just going to the PUC?
Mr. Evans.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to the best of my recollection, and I think I've got this right, it's important, and this is a little bit of a correction of some of the earlier testimony, the importance was not the repeal of the mandate. The 1994 mandate had been met. That mandate was not an energy mandate like our renewable energy standard is. It was a mandate to sign a contract for a certain amount of energy. The law did not specify the length of that contract or anything else about the contract except for what the amount of capacity was that we were supposed to purchase. And so we did purchase that through these three contracts. And so from our point of view, as a legal matter, we had met the state's mandate. There was no further mandate on us in terms of biomass. The question was that we believed and still believe that we could have proceeded to negotiate the buyout of the Benson contract, the buyout of the Benson plant with the current owners, gone to the PUC, and asked permission to close that deal without any additional authority from the legislature. We would have had to work that out within the PUC, which is frankly what we're doing now under the statute. The initiative for the law really had to do with the fact that in the midst of the legislative session, the Laurentian project up on the Iron Range came to us and for about the 15th time in 15 years sought an increase in the price of their energy because they weren't able to make it on what they were getting. And those discussions turned into the possibility of buying out the Laurentian contract as well. And in the course of all of that was when it was determined that if we came to the legislature, we could, you know, get all of this sort of put in a regular order and have the legislature tell the PUC, you know, the process. And of course, in the case of Laurentian and as it turned out with Benson, they wanted additional money beyond what we were willing to pay them to buy out their contract, and that was when the negotiations about the RDA came in. And that was largely because in the case of Benson, the Laurentian project is really two cities, Virginia and Hibbing up there, as well as Benson, and so we felt that it would be better to come into the legislature and present the issue in that way. We tried to get St. Paul Cogen to play as well, but they were not interested, and so it only covered the two plants.
And Mr. Evans, just to be clear, you needed statutory approval to provide direct assistance to Benson and to Laurentian. Excel just can't get out a checkbook and say, Benson, here's $20 million to recoup economic costs. You needed legislation for that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if there was, again, when you did the mandate was, you say, satisfied when you opened the plant. So kind of in that sense is what I heard you say. What was the discussion in about 20 years? Where did that come from? Well, you know, kind of everybody is saying here that there was a 20-year understanding. Some had no cancellation agreements, and they just assumed that was going to be there, and maybe there was actually some written language. But help us then understand why everybody was planning on these huge investments for a 20-year payback.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, when we were required to purchase this energy, and I think I mentioned this before, if you go back and look at the history of that statute, the statute was amended almost every year from the day it was passed, and that was because we just didn't have a natural source of biomass energy. Unlike wind, which was the other part of the 94 mandate, you put up a wind turbine, then you got wind energy. Biomass, as you know, we've heard the testimony here today, requires a lot of infrastructure and a lot of things that frankly didn't exist at the time. And so the statute was changed over and over again to try to accommodate the reality, frankly, that was not recognized in the 94 law. One of the things that happens when you sign a power, essentially we buy that energy through a power purchase agreement, much like we buy our wind energy and some of our solar energy and even some of our gas energy. So you sign a power purchase agreement, we don't own the plant, we just buy the energy. And, of course, if you were going to go and invest in a plant like the Benson plant or the plants up in Laurentian, you're not going to sign an agreement for 1 year of sales, particularly of this very high-priced energy, because after the first year you're out of business and you've made all of that investment. So essentially the power purchase agreements were 20-year agreements, not because the statute required that, because the statute didn't. It was 20-year agreements because those were the terms under which we could buy this energy that we were required by law to buy. And so, but then by the same token, the same parties that agreed to the 20 years could, as in the case of Benson, decide to end the contract early.
Madam Chair? I'd like
Miller.
To punctuate that point. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to punctuate that point that even Excel understood that paying back the costs of doing this business would be over a 20-year period of time, and that's why they came in with those sorts of numbers. Very similar to what we're hearing from the other testifiers.
Thank you. Representative Baker, did you have follow-up questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would agree, I think, and Mr. Evans is spot on, I think that you would never have been able to get folks to supply power for less than certainly 20, probably 20 years, 10 years, I don't think so. I don't think, again, the numbers we're hearing. I wish my colleague, Representative Vogel, was here today, too, to talk about the banking. The banking impact is going to be amazing. You know, I don't know how many local banks or regional banks are going to be affected by this. And again, you've got Mr. Terstig and many others out here that have signed their personal guarantees. I know how hard that is as a business owner to sign a personal guarantee. It scares me to death. And it's just, the story is heartbreaking because the one thing that I think Representative Miller and I were trying to come to was not to come here and try to finagle a way to help risk takers and business owners that are doing that every day. We get that. But when you really pull the rug out, and I'm not saying this is just XL. You've got Benson owners and the power plants, and this is just an embarrassment to the state of how we want to recognize people that want to invest privately, come and provide a product to the state of Minnesota after a legislative mandate back in 1994. And here we sit here, and we've got a whole bunch of people really, really hurt. And I guess I know that we can't, like, snap our fingers and fix this. So from my final question, Mr. Evans, do you support or some kind of a way that, again, I'm happy that there's a lot of ratepayers in XL's district that will save money. That makes me feel good. Not on the backs of these fine folks sitting here. Would you support sort of a throttling down of a type of a rate rider type model or a system that would still show significant savings to the ratepayers, but also that we have some support to help these folks that came to the table? They helped, you know, keep that plan open as long as they could. And again, I think Representative Miller and I were trying to make 2-3 years of some kind of a settlement where we can just give them more time to throttle down and have a better plan. Do you see XL as some kind of a way to help us still save money and help us in that way, Mr. Evans?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, we have in the other body in here would oppose a rate rider. We think our customers have overpaid for this energy for the last 15 years. We think that our customers have paid an enormous cost from the 1994 law, all for the purpose of providing carbon-free baseload energy through our nuclear plants. But I will say this. The other thing that came out of the renewable development or out of the 1994 law was the Renewable Development Fund. Even under the reforms that are being proposed in the various bodies this year, that fund is going to generate over $200 million of our customers' money beyond what we've already committed to the various solar programs and wind programs and other grants that have been made over the years, and beyond what may happen in this body with respect to that fund. Still, after that, our customers over the next, through 2030 is the only numbers I have, but it goes on after that. Through 2030, the next 12 years, we'll collect over $200 million from our customers, for which currently the state has no purpose. It will go over into MMB, and it will be collected over there and sit there until the next purpose comes along. And we said last year, and we say again this year, we think a perfectly legitimate use of the Renewable Development Fund, which is already coming from our customers, is to help the people that were damaged by the closure of the Benson plant, just as we helped the city of Benson last year and just as we helped the Laurentian project this year. So I apologize, I think, Representative Baker, but no, I don't think our customers should have to pay even more money when we've got 200, and I have the exact number I can get for you, hundreds of millions of dollars that are flowing into the Renewable Development Fund over the next 12 years, for which there is no stated purpose in current law. So I'm sorry for that answer. I listen to these folks, too, and I feel for them. I understand what's going on here. You know, when we proposed this last year, we were not aware of this, you know, enormous infrastructure, the city of Benson, everybody else that came out of the woodwork. We worked with them. We ran out of time with the people that were here. We didn't know who they all were and how much they needed or how much they wanted or anything like that. But we were able to work it out with the city of Benson. We said last year, I'll say again this year, we think there's money there to help them out, but the 200 and some odd million dollars our customers are contributing to the RDA already is more, should be more than enough.
And last question, Madam Chair.
Representative Baker.
And I would agree with that. Thank you. I'm not the big fan of the writer either, and I think you're right. And that's why I think I wanted to make sure this committee heard it from Excel as well. That is the best place for this, and I appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Miller. This is a good idea. I would agree the number is not big enough. We also know we've got to push as much as we can, but great conversation, though. Thank you so much.
Mr. Evans, I have a quick question before we move to Representative Mahoney. He's on the list. He'll be next. How long is the Benson and Laurentian plants going to remain open? When is the closure date, Mr. Evans?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Laurentian plant is different. Those plants will continue to operate under their current ownership. Those are actually the municipal utilities of Hibbing and Virginia. Mm-hmm. In addition to providing electricity, they provide steam heat energy to those cities. And so those will continue to operate. We have not closed on the deal to buy out our power purchase agreement with them because we're waiting for regulatory hurdles to be overcome, but we're getting very close to that. In the case of the Benson plant, the current owners have no interest in continuing to operate the facility, so in that case, we're buying out the plant. That deal has not been closed. The old operators are still the operators. We don't own it. I would guess that sometime within the next and I'm guessing here because it's not totally within our control, but sometime within the next 6 to 8 weeks, we would be able to close on the sale. Now, at that point, we don't know, because we don't own the plant, we don't know what the fuel supply is that's on site. We don't know what additional fuel we would need in order to continue to wind the plant down. We don't know what our contracts may be with various parties that supply the fuel. So we don't actually own the plant yet, so we're not in a position to say when it would close. But, I think sometime this summer is certainly looking very likely.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, it's good to see that you can get your blood pressure up more than twice in one session. And I know this is a serious issue, and I don't mean to make light of it, but Mr. Evans, you have such a calm demeanor. It's interesting to see that. I have a series of questions here, but one that just brought to mind as the chair was questioning the closing of the site, who has to clean it up? Is that on your dime, or is that on the current owners?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we will own the plant. We will own building, will own the land, and depending on what the city of Benson wants to do in that location, and what our intention is to take the plant down and return the land to blank space and then sell it.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, thank you. So you could still be on the hook after $20 million to Benson for another $10 or $10 million, depending on what's underneath, all the turkey manure and any other problems. So you are on the hook to clean up the plant site of any pollutants that are there and bring it up to usable standards.
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, I'm not an expert on that, but that sounds logical to me.
Wow.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's another expense I hadn't seen coming, just as I hadn't seen the problem coming with the truckers and everybody else. And I opposed this particular plan for another reason. I was pretty adamant and pretty vocal on it. I'm sad to see that looks to be hundreds of jobs lost here. But did XL have the opportunity through the bankruptcy to renegotiate your contracts with Benson? I mean, it sounds like everybody else renegotiated their contracts, some to the better, some to the worst. But did you have an opportunity to renegotiate? Because normally most companies have an opportunity to renegotiate through a bankruptcy.
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware that our power purchase agreement ever changed. And so I don't know whether there was an opportunity, but I imagine just because of the nature of the
bankruptcy or receivership, it likely the price would not have gone down, and the price would have gone up, and we would not have, you know, wanted to do that. But I'll have to find out if there were any accommodations that we got or made or whatever during the receivership. I'm not aware of any, but it's possible.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm trying to figure out how to formulate this. Earlier you said that you were required to buy a certain amount of power from Benson, from Laurentian, and I believe it would be St. Paul's District Energy. And you said, did you say you had met all those requirements on the biomass legislation? Did you had bought the amount of power you were required to buy?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, you need, I just want to make the distinction here. If you look at something like the Renewable Energy Standard, that requires us to buy a certain amount of energy measured in megawatt hours each year over a period of time. The early 1994 mandates were not a requirement to buy megawatt hours. They were requirement to sign power purchase agreements for a certain amount of capacity. I think originally it was 250 megawatts. So again, megawatts versus megawatt hours. And so, but it was a requirement to sign power purchase agreements for that amount of capacity, which we did. And at that point, we had met those mandates as they're stated in the law. There was no requirement that we do that in perpetuity, or that we do it for 20 years, or 10 years, or 100 years, or 40 years. That was not a requirement of the law.
Representative Mahoney.
Okay, and then just to I'm going to finish this with a statement. I've heard multiple people in this room and multiple times in this room that everyone seems to think Xcel Energy ratepayers have this bottomless pocket. It would take 10 or 15 minutes for me to recite all the requirements of Xcel Energy ratepayers that are not they have to pay that are not on anyone else in this state, period. And I opposed this last year for multiple reasons. So I have a empathy for people with their job. But please don't tell me that my ratepayers, my residents, should be fronting the money for everyone else's problem. If this is a problem and we are going to find a solution for it, it needs to come out of general funds, not out of my back pocket. I have the ability to get my blood up just like Mr. Evans does. And I hear it in this committee, this energy committee. Oh, it's just energy. It's just money out of Xcel Energy ratepayers' pocket, and we'll do a study here, or we'll send money out state or out of state, or we'll do this particular experiment. It benefits the state, but my folks pay for it. It may be pennies, it may be dollars, it may be hundreds of dollars, but my constituents pay for it.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Are there any other member questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Evans and then also one for a Genio person. Mr. Evans, you touched on this about contracts that may be in place, and today we're talking about loggers and the turkey folks. If contracts are in place, either short-term, long-term, for example, if somebody had a contract to deliver wood chips for a couple of years, would those contracts be honored somehow?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, yes, those would be honored. We've said that from the start. Whatever contracts we assume when we purchase the plant will be honored by us.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, thanks. Then I had a question for somebody from Genio, please. And I think this issue with manure storage is a big issue in terms of how long they can hold it on the location of the turkey barn or whatever. So in your estimation, sir, from Genio, you said you'd have to find a new home for about 50% of the manure produced in your operations. In your estimation, is there enough land available or the market by farmers who want to purchase this manure? Or how do you see that going forward? Do we have enough land available to be covered with about 3 tons a year in getting rid of this manure?
Can you restate your name for the record and then can answer the
question? Yes, my name is Matt Shrepp with Genio. We do have enough land. The issue is that we're going to have to move further distance. There's going to have to be new areas developed. We need to find permit new areas and work through, as Paul mentioned, we are right now working with some consultant agronomy services so that we can responsibly apply manure to land, but it's going to involve moving at a further distance to be able to use it.
Representative Anderson.
Then one more. Thanks, Madam Chair. What about having to construct facilities like cement pads to keep this from running away? Increased cost in storage of that, too, I would imagine, correct?
Mr. Shrupp.
Yes, that's correct. We will, because of, Mr. Rothfork mentioned, there are times of the year when we can't land apply in the winter, summer months, obviously, when there's crops on the land that we do need to store that, and that will involve some capital in order to have approved storage sites and meet the requirements for storing that manure.
While we have you up there, I have a quick question for you. I was listening to your testimony, and you talked about your $20 million impact. And you said that before you got involved in hauling all your turkey manure to this facility in Benson, that it was a more profitable method. But I'm trying to understand, if you're going back to a more profitable method, then where's the loss? Mr. Shrupp.
So the more profitable method was a discussion that there's times during the during the contract when it would have been more profitable through the 2007-2008 when the farm economy was very good. There were times when manure was at a higher value than what we would have been able to have more revenue. But we continued to honor our contract with Benson Power, continued to meet the volume needs. So there were times when it was more profitable. Now, when we look at what, as Mr. Rothfork said, just with the closure of the Benson imminent, prices have dropped from $20 a ton to $14 a ton. And also on top of that, it's going to take more freight moving that product a further distance in order to find land for that to be applied on.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp. So when you talk about the freight, is it because the Benson plant paid your freight to the plant? Mr. Sharp.
So the contracts were set up that the freight was paid through Benson. The revenues that were generated were at our farm location, and then the freight was being paid through Benson previously.
Thank you, Mr. Shrupp. Any other member questions? Okay. Seeing none, I just have one other quick question, and I apologize for coming a little bit late, so if I missed it. If I understand this correctly, when the truckers came in and they said that these trucks can't haul anything else, I'm not sure who had testified to that. If the person that had testified about the truckers would come back down. Thank you. Thank you. I'll ask the question, and then you can restate your name. There was the testimony that said they can't haul anything else other than what they were designed for. My question is, I've talked to people that build roads, and they said they got a really sweet deal because just as the turkey litter folks said that the Benson plant paid basically back and forth for that load to go, that they actually put their loads on for a really cheap price and were able to haul things to build roads in those trucks. And so I'm just asking if you could please clarify that those trucks, in fact, cannot haul anything else. And I've heard other things out in the community, talking to folks that actually put things on those trucks on the return trip, and they got a really cheap price. So if you could address that. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, I'm Steve Scalarud. I'm the owner of Hull's Brothers Trucking. First of all, just to kind of restate what I said was, what we have is very specialized equipment, especially in the trailers. They're very large. They're not designed to haul gravel. You need a trailer about half as large, okay, that weighs a lot less. We get paid by the ton in the end dump business. We also, in the state of Minnesota, have a business. If you don't have a business that runs year-round and you're not hauling turkey litter to Benson, for example, you have a business that runs about 6 or 7 months out of the year because there is no rock to haul when the temperature is below 32 because they can't make rock at the quarries. I do think it is true that some of the back hauls are less expensive due to Benson. The issue is if I don't have Benson, I'm not going to be doing the back haul at all because while Benson represents 55% of my revenue, it represents 95% of my profit. And it does that because, A, I can run it year-round. B, it's consistent. I can hire and staff to it. And if you take away a 55% revenue position and a 95% profit position, you can't afford to haul anything else, any of these construction products, whether they're getting a deal or not. The margin on the construction products that you're referencing is between 0 and 5% based on a per-mile haul.
Thank you. So your testimony now is that you could haul other things. It's just not as profitable as hauling it to and from Benson.
Yeah, we can haul other things, but we can't do it at a profit. Not with the equipment that we have. So I'm competing for rock and aggregate and construction business with people who have frameless end dumps, which weigh about 30% less than mine. Yet, if you're the customer who wants aggregates hauled, you're not going to pay me more just because my trailers are heavier.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. And then the last question I have before we wrap up is the person that came about the chipping of the wood and they can't sell. Thank you. The person that testified about you can't sell your product, your machinery anywhere else because nobody in the entire United States would buy this machinery, I think is what the testimony was. I apologize. I did come in a little bit late, so if I got that wrong. So my question is about the chippers and all this infrastructure that you purchased. You had stated that this can't be sold to anybody else in the entire United States. You can't liquidate your equipment. Can you clarify that? Is that an accurate statement, or can you actually sell your equipment elsewhere in the United States to do this? And just restate your name for the record and then please add.
Yes, I'm Sean Fletcher with Fletcher Trucking.
Okay.
And, yes, I'm sure we could sell it for scrap metal or a very cheap price. I mean, we paid... one chipper is $500,000. What will they be worth when this is over? Probably 100. So yeah, you could sell them, but I know that the dealer up north at Grand Rapids, they're a Nortrak or the Moorpark dealer you're talking about, they give back their dealership. They don't even want to take a chipper on trade. Period. For any amount of money, they don't want no part of them. I mean, this is, and as far as Rick Evans talked about, Hibbing is going to continue to go. Well, I got to call on Thursday. We're done at Hibbing. They are done. They're going to discontinue electric power there, and they're going to only run steam temporary in the winter months, like maybe November on to the winter months, until they get switched over to natural gas or coal or whatever they do. So if they're still running, I'd like to go there. So it's more of an impact than what everybody thinks. XL's made very light of the subject, like it's no big deal, but it's a much bigger deal than what they think.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. So your testimony is you can't sell it anywhere in the United States. You can only sell it for scrap. Is that accurate, Mr.
At a very low number, yeah. Sure. Yeah, we could sell it, but it'd be very, very cheap.
Mr. Fletcher, can you explain why that would be? Why is there no one else in the whole United States doing this sort of operation, Mr. Fletcher?
The biomass has kind of took wind through the whole U.S. from what I gather. The natural gas being so cheap, it just drove through the whole U.S. of the biomass facilities getting hammered on.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. So this is something that's happening across the entire United States, not unique to Minnesota.
I think it is happening across the U.S., yes. Mm-hmm. But I'm not no expert on it, but that's from what I gather.
But that's why you can't sell your equipment anywhere else in the United States, because no one else is doing this either.
It's slowed down. Where they are doing it, I think it's slowed down. It's not picking up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay.
And not only that, there's going to be a massive flood of equipment.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. Are there any other final member questions? Seeing none, Representative Miller, I'll give you the final word.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And again, committee members, thank you very much for coming in. I do have a couple final comments, but I will be brief. I know we do have session. I just want to punctuate what you heard this morning. We have a really bad situation here. And I think it's very fair to say that we want to respect the ratepayers and lower the rate pay. This was very expensive energy, and it wasn't a good deal. But we did make that agreement back then, and we have to honor those agreements. I believe the RFA funding is probably based on everything everyone said, and I agree with Mr. Evans with Excel. The RFA is probably the best source for this because I don't support the rate rider personally because it adds on to the ratepayers. But Representative Mahoney, I would also say that the general fund money goes to the taxpayers, but you're certainly a taxpayer also. This is not fair to those people to say that we have to compensate for something that we made. I looked at the RFA as a fund. I don't take lightly, but as a fund that's already been dedicated to a pool of money, as Mr. Evans said, $200 million by the year 2030, I'm asking for $40 million. I can certainly tell you that if I could have given a number to everyone that came up here and testified that said we certainly need more than $40 million, I would have agreed with that. But I'm sure that all of you in this committee know that even asking for $40 million is like an outrageous amount to come before this body and say I want $40 million. That was our compromise position down to that incredible, incredible number that's not seriously enough. I did want to make mention of one thing just to clarify, is that, yes, Excel is going to honor their agreements that they've had with all these people, but as was testified earlier, the termination agreement, some of these other things that were done just prior to all this that happened in legislation last year, which seems awful coincidental, put them in a position that when this shuts down, we're talking 30 days. We're not talking an agreement. And I think I should punctuate the fact that Excel themselves said they can only make this work with a 20-year agreement. Well, if they can only make it work with a 20-year agreement with all the assets and resources that Excel has, can you imagine a trucking company that has a half dozen trucks? This has come about because what Representative Baker, myself, Senator Lang, there's been some other people. We had lots of discussions in a very truncated period of time last year. We heard a couple days before Easter, which, as you know, in the legislative season, makes it very short to deal with things last year. We felt that we dealt with things as quickly and efficiently as we possibly could. But as you also heard, if there was 11 years left on this, these companies wouldn't have a problem. I heard 5 years, if we can have 5 years. I heard 3 years. I heard 2 years, if we could have 2 years. But we weren't able to do anything like that. This has been truncated down to a very short period of time. So do I like throwing money onto a fire? I don't like it at all, but I feel that this is our only recourse. My bill accounts for only a fraction. We did not get into the tenets of the bill because this was certainly not the time or place. I wish we had the time or place to do this. I can tell you it's very difficult. The Office of Administrative Hearings came forward and said, we're going to help you build a structure because this is going to be a fraction of the losses. We believe we have a way that's certainly not going to make any of these people whole, not even close. But for the 2 or 3 years that we were asking for, maybe this will compensate a little bit to account for that. I don't think it's really going to happen. As a business owner myself, as Representative Baker's a business owner, we assume risk every day with what we do. And sometimes our decisions we don't recognize have major implications down the road, and we have to be held accountable for that. But I hold this legislature also accountable because we made a very big decision last year. It was a good decision, believe me, for ratepayers, but look at the impact that it had. We certainly need to address those problems as well. I ask for this committee's support as we move forward. We're not voting here today. The Senate, I think in a committee I can say this, the Senate is moving much further on this, and this is going to come up later in session. I wanted all of you to know what exactly is going on. If any of you have further questions, this is a much more complicated issue than just what we addressed this morning. I'd be happy to address those because I certainly hope that we can help these people in some way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miller. And before we adjourn, we do have to move the minutes from April 20th. I will move the minutes from April 20th. Any discussion, changes, or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes from April 20th, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you, and we are concluded with our business.